250 years since America's founding. We're on a Ferris wheel in the National Mall in Washington, D.C., celebrating. And we're here with a sister. We've got the story from a Catholic perspective, America's 250th, coming up.
As we celebrate America's 250th anniversary, we examine the role of Catholicism in our country's rich history. We speak to everyday Catholics and get insight from two leading Catholic historians. A blockbuster term for the United States Supreme Court, Catholic analysis on the birthright citizenship case, important immigration rulings, and the decision concerning biological males in women's sports.
We were very excited about it, and we didn't think they were going to come all the way out here to Peaks Island.
And we are on the waterways of Maine at the most northern point of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. Our journey with the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist continues. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
We have to make sure that we're living for Jesus, with Jesus, and in Jesus.
Wise words of faith on the Ferris wheel. Americans of all backgrounds and vocations are gathering in our nation's capital to celebrate a very special Independence Day this weekend. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Tomorrow marks 250 years since 13 defiant colonies declared their independence against a global empire, becoming the United States of America. Well, before that fateful day on July 4th, 1776, Catholics have evangelized this nation and shaped its history. But what does it mean to be an American Catholic? Reporter Mark Irons has traveled across the country to find out.
America is turning 250 years old.
There's no other country in the world that has the liberty and the freedoms that this country has.
The celebrations have already begun around the country. And in our nation's capital, there's even a fair. A ride on the giant Ferris wheel outside the halls of Congress provides stunning views as you look back to how this all began.
Sister, 250 years of America, what does it mean to you?
Well, of course, everything, in the sense of this is where I was born and raised.
Of course, when you meet nuns in line for a Ferris wheel, you can't pass up the opportunity to join for a ride, and on this occasion, share some red, white, and blue reflections.
We are so blessed that we probably take it all for granted. We don't really get up every morning and think, oh, look what we have here.
What do we have? Well, not far from the Ferris wheel, the National Archives building lets you go inside and take a look.
This is the rotunda where our founding documents are preserved. On July 4th, 1776, the founding fathers laid out the reasons for our separation with Great Britain in the Declaration of Independence. And 250 years later, people are lining up to take a look at that freedom-defining document.
Though the signatures on the Declaration of Independence are quite faded now, the contributions of each founding father can't be erased, including those of the only Catholic signer, Charles Carroll. But the story of Catholicism in America begins centuries before Carroll or the Declaration he signed.
This is really where Catholicism started in the United States.
In 1565, Spanish missionaries landed in St. Augustine, Florida, establishing the first permanent Catholic settlement. Katie Lockard is the archivist in the Diocese of St. Augustine.
I am thrilled because I am the steward of the oldest Catholic records in the country.
Inspecting the records, she has an insight into what the foundations of faith in America would have looked like.
St. Augustine was a really multicultural community. And so it's really clear that everybody was invited and there was a lot of evangelization that happened in this area. We have instances of people of color, indigenous, Spanish.
In many ways, Catholicism and how it has remained in America is an immigrant story.
Our current course recalls calls the voyages of approximately 12 million American immigrants. Wow. They passed through these waters.
Very cool that, you know, they not only came here with their faith, but then continued it.
Waves of Catholic immigrants from many countries were processed through Ellis Island outside New York City, passing the Statue of Liberty as they approached. For over a year now, we've been documenting this story of American Catholicism from the past to present.
Excuse me, does anybody want to be on TV? We're talking about Catholicism in America. You guys got some thoughts? Do we have a Catholic here?
We're all Catholic.
You're all Catholic.
You yourself, you're Catholic?
Totally.
Totally Catholic, he says.
In the early days of America, some Catholics may not have shown their faith so proudly. We did face forms of persecution as a religious minority. But the Founding Fathers imagined a place where all would be able to worship freely.
Do you find that you are able to practice your faith well in America?
Absolutely. Most decidedly.
A country that tolerates and respects different religions.
Are you a person of faith yourself?
I am.
What's your faith background?
I'm Muslim.
When you think of Catholicism, what do you think of?
I think of all the work that Catholicism has done abroad in helping the impoverished people all around the globe, you know?
One shining example of that, the missionary from Chicago who would shepherd his flock in Peru and ultimately become our first American pope. Pope Leo XIV has caught the attention not just of Catholics.
I'm not a Catholic, but I think it's a tremendous point of national pride.
I'm not Catholic, but I thought about converting. The Catholic faith is pretty beautiful, I won't deny that.
Which brings us to a question. The beauty of the Catholic faith and living it in this beautiful country, what does that look like now, going forward?
Can you be fully American and fully Catholic? Like, what does that mean?
Right, to be an American patriot and a Catholic are not in opposition.
Father Aquinas Gilbo is chaplain and vice president of ministry and mission at the Catholic University of America.
Liberty is a gift to be cherished, but it can be very easily abused and misunderstood and misused. And every American Christian has to achieve in life how bring our civic liberties and the gospel command to love together.
He points us to Bishop Fulton Sheen, a mid-20th century American clergyman whose fearless approach to sharing the faith captivated and inspired a national TV audience.
I think he had an understanding of freedom that certainly many of the founders would have articulated, that freedom is not license, that freedom is responsibility to pursue the good.
Over the past year, we've heard from many people. Some, though free, feel lost.
I currently am not a practicing Catholic. That's one thing I really miss in my life now, that I don't have like any sense of community.
Others are beginning to find it. And when you give it the bird's eye view, at least from Sister Mary Angela's perspective, there is much to be grateful for.
What do you think the state of the Catholic faith in this country is?
Growing and thriving. I think if I had to say something.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
As we celebrate the 250th anniversary of our nation's founding this weekend and look at the role Catholicism has played in America's story, we are joined now by two distinguished Catholic historians. Dr. Kathleen Sprouse Cummings is the John A. O'Brien Collegiate Professor of American Studies and History at the University of Notre Dame, where she is also the director of the university's Global Catholic Research Initiative. And Dr. Christopher Shannon is an Associate Professor of History at Christendom College, where he teaches a course on American Catholic history. He's also author of American Pilgrimage, A Historical Journey Through Catholic Life in a New World. Thank you both for joining us this week in particular. Kathleen, I'm going to start with you. We cannot discuss Catholicism in the U.S. without addressing the discrimination that Catholics have faced throughout U.S. history, especially as waves of Catholic immigrants made their way through Ellis Island into our country, largely in the 19th century. Can you take us back to the reality that immigrant Catholics faced, particularly during that time?
Sure. It's hard to imagine today the extent to which Catholics were seen as not welcome in the United States. And the Catholic migrants from Europe in the 19th century had at least three strikes against them. They were very poor. They were from countries that were seen as undesirable, like particularly Ireland in the first half of the 19th century. And then later in the 19th century, from places like Italy and southern other places in southern and eastern Europe. And then finally, they were loyal to the Pope. And anti-Catholicism in the 19th century often meant anti-papism, as many Americans believed that the Pope had imperial designs on the United States and that immigrants were going to help engineer a papal takeover. Mm.
Chris, on that very note, there has historically been this tension between American patriotism and Catholicism. Tell us more about that. And do you think, does that tension persist today?
Yeah, I think when Kathleen said it's hard to imagine, you know, a time when, and part of the reason is because Catholics seem just so darn American now, you know, that it's hard to imagine there was a time when they were different. And I think that speaks to this issue of the tension between being Catholic in America and being patriotic Americans. Catholics are always patriotic, but they were kind of patriotic on their own terms, particularly the way that they lived their life, both their faith and their patriotism, in a kind of local urban communities that really seemed like, you know, just foreign countries to so much of the rest of America. And if there's less tension, I think, today between being Catholic and being American, it's largely because of that cultural difference and some of the religious difference as well has disappeared. And I think that's the real kind of, to me, the main kind of issue that Catholics have to think about as they look back on these 250 years and where are we now?
And I do want to come back to that shortly, but Kathleen, first, who are some American Catholic saints you might like to highlight for our viewers? I understand you serve as board chair at the National Shrine of St. Francis Cabrini in Chicago, the first American to be canonized a saint.
That's right. The first American citizen to be canonized a saint in 1946. And actually, in just a few days, we'll be celebrating the 80th anniversary of Francis Cabrini's canonization, which took place right after the Second World War. It was a time when the Europe and the world was emerging from the horrors of war. And it was a wonderful chance to celebrate how patriotism and sanctity blended in the life of this remarkable woman. And of course, Pope Leo visited her birthplace in northern Italy just 2 weeks ago. Yeah. So another wonderful opportunity. I also think, though, about the first American-born saint, Elizabeth Ann Seton, who was born in 1774, so technically a British subject. And as people who were promoting her cause like to say, Seton grew up with the nation. She converted to Catholicism and founded one of the first religious communities of women in this country, some of the first Catholic schools. And then I can't help but think of Bishop John Newman, who was Bishop of Philadelphia, and his shrine and where he lived was just steps away from Independence Hall. So when his cause for canonization was open, the Redemptorists who were promoting it often suggested pairing a pilgrimage to the Newman Shrine with a visit to Independence Hall or Valley Forge Battlefield. So again, that blending of patriotism and sanctity in the lives of these holy people.
That's a really fitting reminder for this week in particular. Chris, looking at Catholics in politics, Al Smith was the first Catholic to be nominated for U.S. president by a major political party, and that was in 1928, and he faced severe anti-Catholic prejudice. John F. Kennedy, of course, famously became the first Catholic U.S. president in 1961. But, Chris, in order for Catholics to be accepted today into politics in particular, is it possible to see them live an authentically Catholic witness in a public position, or do they have to kind of check the tenets of faith at the door?
I guess option B seems to be the historical record, because on a couple of fronts, like, you can't imagine two Irish Catholics more different from Al Smith and Kennedy. Culturally, certainly, Smith came out of one of the, you know, kind of the urban ethnic world, where Kennedy was completely airbrushed, if you will, and WASP and everything, but where he went to church on Sunday. But the fact that Kennedy pretty much had to deny that his faith would have anything to do with his public life, and it says a lot. You know, it's one thing to, of course, you're not going to impose your faith on anybody, but you're saying, I can't live my Catholic faith in public. That's, again, I think very, very, very troubling. And when you look at what's happened, you know, in the last 50 years or so, you find very few candidates, certain Catholic politicians, certainly beyond the level of, say, congressmen in a local district, that to me reflect the fullness of Catholic teaching, what's sometimes called the seamless garment or the consistent life ethic. will. They have to make their compromises with the two options that we have available to us. And those compromises, to me, are very compromising of Catholic teaching in various areas.
So that tension persists to this day. Kathleen, here we are. You know, we have our first U.S.-born Pope in Pope Leo XIV. What does it mean for American Catholicism that Pope Leo is our first U.S.-born Pope?
It's amazing. It was a wonderful, it is a wonderful moment for U.S. Catholics. And then from the perspective of American history, it's truly astonishing. The concept of an American Pope for most of this country's history would have been a travesty at home and an absurdity in Rome. Americans believed, again, that American and Catholic was an oxymoron, and an American Pope even more so. And then from the perspective of the Vatican, the conventional wisdom had long held that Americans weren't linguistically or culturally familiar enough with Rome in order to be elected. So when you take the long view, it's even more astonishing. And I think particularly this Pope, and when we look at his trajectory and his the fact that he spent so much of his life in South America, so much in Rome. Yes, he's a U.S. citizen and a patriotic U.S. citizen and a White Sox fan and all of that. But he also views the world not primarily through an American filter, but through a Catholic lens. And in that sense, he's a member of a universal church. And it, it was those qualities that appealed to the cardinal electors. So yes, we should be proud that we have an American Pope. Villages and cities in Italy got to celebrate this 217 times. It's our turn. But I think we also need to remember that it's what's important is not that he's a U.S. citizen, but that he is the leader of the world's Catholics.
Finally, I want to end on this note, as we are now heading into the anniversary of our country's founding. Just reflect on this moment that we're in right now. Here we are in 2026. We have the second Catholic Vice President of the United States, J.D. Vance. The first was Joe Biden. We're about to beatify the first U.S.-born bishop, Fulton Sheen. And as we just mentioned, we have the first U.S.-born pope at the Vatican. How significant is this chapter right now for American Catholicism? Chris, I'll start with you.
Well, the numbers look good. I mean, everything that you just described would suggest a kind of a Catholic moment of arrival. But again, I tend to be the party poop here. That when you think of the dust up between our Catholic vice president and our American Catholic Pope, that should give one some pause for celebration. That you know, I certainly side with the Pope in that dust up, but the fact that such a high ranking Catholic, second highest in the country, could publicly, you know, quarrel with and really kind of pretty much tell the Pope to mind his own business. To me, there's kind of certainly, this is party concerns, but also the echoes of Kennedy there, that, okay, you know, I'm going to show that I can be a good American while being a Catholic by saying I am not going to follow the authority of the Pope. He's speaking on matters of life and death that one doesn't have to be a Catholic to agree with. You know, these are not distinctly Catholic issues or that stand for peace. So that's my my kind of cautionary reflection on the state of things.
And Kathleen, we'll end with you, a brief reflection on this moment for American Catholicism.
Well, I tend to be more optimistic, but I do agree with my colleague that there's a lot to lament right now. Let's just start with the beatification, though, of Fulton Sheen for a note of hope. I mean, Sheen was someone who historically was able to unite through his calling, but through his unique gifts as an orator, as a television, and before that, radio personality, was able to knit the American way and Catholic truth together in a way that was very appealing. So as we celebrate his beatification and look at his life, perhaps he can give an example of someone who really harnessed the latest technology of his period in order to spread the Catholic faith. And who are the people that are doing that today in this country? And that, I think, gives us more reason for.
That's a great reminder for us all. Well, thank you both for joining us. We really appreciate your insights. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have more July 4th Americana ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. But first, some important rulings this week from the U.S. Supreme Court on birthright, citizenship, immigration, and athletes who identify as transgender in school. Plus,
Armistice Outrageous aboard a ferry heading to Portland, Maine. It is the northernmost stop of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. More on the pilgrimage in Maine coming up.
We are on the northern tip of the St. Francis Xavier Cabrini pilgrimage route. The straightforward people of Maine share plain talk about the impact of Christ in their community.
What does America mean to you?
Everything.
I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to freely express my beliefs and my faith without fear of persecution.
With the end of June comes the end of another blockbuster term at the Supreme Court. In several high-profile cases, the justices ruled on major flashpoints for our nation, from gender ideology to the White House's strategy on economics and immigration. One of the biggest cases concerned President Donald Trump's retaliatory tariffs on nearly every country in the world. The court determined the tariffs exceeded presidential powers. But in two rulings from last week, there were also wins for the administration. Justices paved the way for the administration to remove temporary protected status from hundreds of thousands of Haitian and Syrian nationals in the U.S., as well as turn back asylum seekers before they reach the U.S.-Mexico border. And in perhaps the most closely watched case this term, the Supreme Court rejected President Donald Trump's executive order seeking to end birthright citizenship, a legal principle that guarantees citizenship to babies born in the U.S. The court determined the order was unconstitutional because it contradicted the 14th Amendment, which confers citizenship on anyone, quote, born in the United States and subject to jurisdiction thereof. The decision impacts more than 200,000 babies born in the U.S. each year. The court was nearly split down the middle. Five justices joined Chief Justice John Roberts in his majority opinion. Brett Kavanaugh agreed with the court's result, but not its reasoning. Three justices dissented. In his majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts writes, "Citizenship, then and now, was the right to have rights to freely participate in our political community. The framers of the 14th Amendment extended that promise to every free-born person in this land. We keep that promise today." Justice Samuel Alito called the majority decision, quote, "a serious mistake" in his dissent. The 14th Amendment confers citizenship on only those children who at birth owe allegiance solely to this country. As we continue to unpack the significance of the Supreme Court's immigration ruling this week, our next guest brings a profoundly unique and Catholic perspective to the immigration debate. Paul Hunker is a partner at a Texas law firm that provides legal representation to immigrants on issues ranging from asylum and green card assistance to deportation defense and work visas and other complex immigration issues. Prior to being an immigration attorney, Paul served as the chief counsel for ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, in Dallas. Paul, thanks so much for being with us. Immigration enforcement is one of, if not the most, charged political topics in this country. You have this unique perspective, having defended both the government and the immigrant in this debate. Can you give us your reaction to the Supreme Court's decision to uphold birthright citizenship in the United States?
Yes, I read the majority decision this morning, and I was really inspired. I felt like standing up and singing the national anthem. It was a great defense of citizenship at birth, that in the United States, we're not citizens because we're of a particular race. We're citizens because we're born in the United States. I think it's a great, profound decision affirming a fundamental idea of our nation.
Paul, only about three dozen countries in the world offer automatic birthright citizenship, including the United States. From what you have seen firsthand, do you see that this is a right that is often abused by immigrant families? And what is your message to Americans who are concerned by that?
Well, I mean, certainly some people will engage in what's called birth tourism. They may come here and have a child who is a citizen of the United States when that child is born here. But I say this is this idea of having new U.S. citizens is something profoundly good for our country, that those those children can acclimate to the United States and become contributing members of the United States. And frankly, our nation needs more people. Mm-hmm. Our birth rate is declining, and we really need more people. So we should incentivize and we should support policies that give us more citizens rather than fewer citizens. Mm-hmm.
The Trump administration did have some immigration Supreme Court victories this term. The court ruled the president has broad, unrestrained authority to end the temporary protected status program, and the court ruled in favor of the government's ability to turn back asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. Paul, how significant are these rulings, and were you surprised by them?
I was not surprised by those rulings. In principle, temporary protected status is temporary, and the law and the regulations allow the administration to take it away if they follow the law and the regulations to do so. I think there were many ways the administration did not do that, so I was somewhat mm-hmm. disappointed in the Supreme Court decision. I believe we do need a strong border, and I disagree with the decision that basically prohibits people from applying for asylum if they enter the United States illegally. I think there's better ways to do that, to consider those asylum applications on the border before those persons are allowed into the United States, adjudicate those decisions quickly. And I think that's the way to do it, to give people their due process rather than denying them due process, and often that due process and often that denial is mm-hmm. could send someone back to their country where they could be persecuted or killed on account of their political or religious views.
Well, Paul, on that note, I know you're a practicing Catholic. For Catholics who want both secure borders and a humane immigration system that upholds the dignity of the human person, what are immigration enforcement reforms that you would recommend?
Well, you definitely need a strong border for a number of reasons, and it wasn't simply the Biden administration's fault, but for a number of reasons, the border was crazy under the Biden administration. The numbers of people apprehended were like over 100,000 people were apprehended per month crossing the border, basically turning themselves in to be let into the United States. That has to stop. On the other hand, there are people in the United States that have been here many years, have significant family ties, are contributing to our country. And those people, the Trump administration is seeking to remove those people. And that's very harmful for society. Mm-hmm. So what we need is a strong border. I believe we need a reform in the law to give people that have been here a long time, that are contributing members to our society, that are not criminals, to give them a pathway mm-hmm. to obtain their lawful status. And we need more legal immigration. We need a lot more legal immigration, Catherine. Our country mm-hmm. Our country's birth rate isn't high enough. We need people to come in and contribute and support the United States.
Mm-hmm. Paul, tomorrow on the 4th of July, Pope Leo XIV, our first U.S.-born pope, will visit the Italian island of Lampedusa, which is seen as Europe's Ellis Island of sorts. It's a gateway for thousands of migrants from Africa and the Middle East to come to Italy and Europe. Our Holy Father is expected to offer comfort and encouragement to those who are there. I'm curious, Paul, as to your reaction about this gesture from our Holy Father, and how significant is it coming from an American pope?
I think it's very significant. I think, unfortunately, the media often mischaracterizes these things as if the Pope is for open borders. Mm-hmm. The Pope just wants, says countries should just let people in en masse. And that's what the church is saying. If you read what the Pope is saying, he's talking about that, for example, for people fleeing harm, that it needs to be an international solution, that countries need to get together and decide how these people that are fleeing harm can be protected, and that burden should be shared. So I think it is an important thing that the Pope is doing. I think, unfortunately, including our own administration, that people's rights are being denied. Mm-hmm. For example, when the Trump administration sent many innocent Venezuelans to a Salvadoran terrorist mm-hmm. camp, that the Pope and the church and our bishops are speaking out against that. Mm-hmm. And they're speaking out against an indiscriminate detentions and removals. Mm. Now, look, you can protect the border without arresting grandma selling tacos mm. on the street. And I hope that maybe in the second term, or maybe it's going to take a new president, that we could do that. We can protect the border. We can have a safe community. Mm. We can remove people that are dangerous. And we can facilitate deserving non-citizens obtaining lawful status.
Paul, we have less than a minute left, but I want to end on this note. Our discussion, we've been talking about immigrant families coming to the United States for the promise of a better life. So as we head into this weekend and celebrations surrounding our country's founding, can you just reflect about what does make our country great today and why the U.S. continues to attract new citizens?
Well, I have friends like from Brazil, and they come here and they say, my kids can play in a park and they're not going to be robbed. Mm. And there's safety, there's rule of law. And I think you see that rule of law in this decision yesterday, that at various times in history, the government has exceeded their ability to regulate immigration and they've taken away rights. And the courts have pushed back on that. And I think that's a great thing about our country is checks and balances, that we have a judiciary that can check the excesses of Congress or the president.
Paul Hunker, thank you so much for your insight and for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Catherine.
In other high court news, on Tuesday, their final day of opinions, the justices determined states can prohibit biological males from competing in women's sports. The court rejected arguments that Title IX requires schools to let males play in women's sports and ruled safety and competitive fairness are important interests of equal protection. Mary Rice Hassan is senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and co-founder and director of the Person and Identity Project, notes 27 states have enacted laws protecting women's sports.
This opinion says you are standing on solid ground. This is not discriminatory. This is, in fact, the intent of the law. It does say something also to those 23 other states that do not have similar laws that restrict participation in female sports to females only. I think what my hope will be that there will be a rise in activism within those states to say, to push the legislatures to enact laws that really will secure women's sports for women.
The court ruled 6-3 along ideological lines with only partial dissents from the three liberal justices. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court struck down a Colorado law that prevented Christian counselors from helping minors struggling with unwanted same-sex attraction. This week, the justices agreed to hear another case concerning gender, and this one involves parental rights. A group of parents have sued the state of Washington over a law that does not require parents to be notified if a runaway child is seeking gender transition procedures. The Supreme Court will decide whether those parents have legal standing and can proceed with the lawsuit. Oral arguments will take place sometime next term, which begins in October. And of course, EWTN News will remain on the Supreme Court beat to provide Catholic analysis, focusing on those decisions with direct significance to Catholic Church teaching. News headlines are next in the Week in Review.
I'm proud. I'm proud. I was born and raised here. I believe in our ideals.
I've instilled patriotism in my daughter. I grew up in a military family, so patriotism and pro-America is instilled in me.
A desperate search and rescue mission in the wake of Venezuela's devastating earthquakes tops the Week in Review. More than a week after two historic quakes hit the city of La Guaira and surrounding areas, hopes of finding survivors fades with each passing hour. Apocalyptic scenes from the ground of Venezuela as civilians search rubble for friends and families with bare hands and shovels. More than 2,200 people have died and tens of thousands are still missing. Though Venezuela is rich in oil, a severe gasoline shortage means crucial heavy machinery cannot be used to help sort through debris. Thanks to the persistence of locals and the help of international aid workers, survivors continue to be found even days after the earthquakes. But a search and rescue specialist from the United Nations warns time is running out.
Most rescues take place within the first 3 days. There is a subsequent window between 3 and 7 days where search and rescue operations are still possible, though the probability of success drops significantly. While there are documented cases of people being found after 7 days, Those would be miraculous rescues.
Many Venezuelans have expressed frustration at the authoritarian government's failure to quickly and adequately respond to the disaster and say locals and international agents have taken the brunt of the humanitarian response. The earthquakes have compounded an already dire economy and political turmoil. Talks between the U.S. and Iran appear back on track after the two countries exchanged attacks across the Persian Gulf earlier this week. U.S. jets struck Iranian military targets near the Strait of Hormuz after Iran attacked a Panama-flagged tanker. Tehran answered with strikes on U.S. infrastructure in Kuwait and Bahrain. But even as the waterway remains a key sticking point, American and Iranian officials noted successful indirect talks in Qatar on Wednesday. Vice President J.D. Vance told reporters that discussions are centered around traffic through the strait, and the much more complicated issue of Iran's nuclear program will be discussed later.
We've got now oil at $68. We've got gas prices starting to come down, but really just ensuring that we continue to make the progress on that. And that's what they're focused on. And then, you know, we're going to obviously we're worried about the nuclear issue. We're going to start talking about that. So right now the talks are going well. It's still pretty early, but talks are going well.
Tomorrow, Iran will begin nearly a full week of funeral ceremonies for its former supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The Ayatollah, whose brutal regime stamped out widespread protests earlier this year, was killed in late February during the U.S.-Israeli strikes. Tehran has warned Washington and Tel Aviv of, quote, harsh and regret-inducing responses if they attack the country during the funeral. A study has found that more than 2 million troops have been killed or wounded in the war in Ukraine, a grim milestone in a conflict that has raged on for more than 4 years. Russian troops account for more than 1.4 million of those casualties. Moscow has been able to maintain its troop levels by enlisting felons and debtors, deploying soldiers from its ally North Korea, and carrying out its first draft since World War II. The figures highlight Russia's halting progress in Ukraine, but completely accurate estimates remain uncertain. Ukraine does not disclose its numbers, and Russia is believed to undercount. Despite repeated warnings from Rome, the Society of St. Pius X, or SSPX, has consecrated four bishops without a papal mandate. The Vatican has confirmed those four bishops, as well as two other bishops who participated in the consecration, have committed an act of schism, and they, along with clergy and lay faithful who adhere to the traditionalist group, are excommunicated. The consecrations took place in front of thousands in Econ, Switzerland on Wednesday. The Vatican has issued several warnings to the SSPX to pause its plans. Pope Leo XIV himself made a final appeal to the society the day before the consecrations to change course because, quote, to tear the seamless garment of Christ is a sin of extreme gravity. The excommunication now means any SSPX weddings or confessions are invalid. Dr. Matthew Bunsen, editorial director of EWTN News, emphasizes that Pope Leo's approach to the SSPX is similar to his predecessors.
We have seen popes reaching out consistently. Pope Leo XIV has, again, made appeals. He has asked for dialogue. So he has gone out of his way to try to prevent this from happening. This is about authority. And from that standpoint, those who do these actions incur automatic excommunication from the church.
The SSPX, which has long held doctrinal differences with the Second Vatican Council, announced the illicit consecrations earlier this year, arguing that they were necessary to ensure the group needed to ordain new priests and replace surviving elderly bishops. Rome offered to reopen dialogue with the society if they did not move ahead with the ceremony, but the SSPX declined. On Thursday, shortly after releasing its decree of the excommunication, the Vatican also shared the procedure for SSPX priests and lay faithful to return to Catholic communion. To learn more about the Vatican response to the SSPX and what it means for the lay faithful, go to EWTNnews.com for in-depth explanations and analysis. Pope Leo bestowed a pallium on 35 new archbishops this week, including four from the United States. This special vestment has ancient roots and symbolizes pastoral authority and unity with the Pope. The Holy Father bestowed the pallia on the archbishops during Mass for the Solemnity of Saints Peter and Paul on Monday at the Vatican. The small garment of white wool with black crosses reflects the archbishop's role as shepherd of his flock and his unity with the Pope. You can see the Holy Father, and now these archbishops wear the pallium around their neck when they offer Mass. Among the four Americans who received the pallium are Archbishop Ronald Hicks of New York, who reflected on the special moment with EWTN News.
Being in his presence and praying to the Lord through the Holy Spirit as that pallium was put on me, I was filled with joy and awe, a sense of humility, a humbleness, just who am I? I am not worthy. Some of those things, and at the same moment of feeling this bond of unity with him and this beautiful call that I've received, it was awe-inspiring. It was overwhelming in a beautiful way.
The other three American archbishops who received the pallium this week are Archbishop James Golka of Denver, Archbishop James Checchio of New Orleans, and Archbishop Mark Rivetuso of Mobile, Alabama. For centuries, popes have annually given the pallia to newly appointed archbishops in Rome. Pope Leo has returned to this tradition after his predecessor, Pope Francis, decided to let apostolic nuncios bestow the vestments on archbishops locally. We go to New England's Pine Tree State next.
While we were walking with the Eucharistic processions and in the masses and the adorations, we just saw this peace, and it's beautiful to see.
Peaceful life in the state of Maine, enhanced by the true presence of Christ. We are on the pilgrimage trail when we return.
Today is my 60th birthday. Thank you. And I could not think of a better way to celebrate my birthday, a milestone, than to be part of this procession, to worship and adore the living Jesus Christ.
Catholics in Maine came out to welcome and process with the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist on the northernmost part of this summer's National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. The journey on the St. Francis Xavier Cabrini route nears completion this weekend in Philadelphia. After reaching Maine and then processing south this week through Massachusetts and Rhode Island on its way to its final destination this July 4th weekend in the city of brotherly love, the birthplace of America. EWTN News in-depth reporter Roselle Regis made the trek up north to Maine, where she found Catholics there pleased that pilgrimage organizers decided to include a state considered one of the least religious in America today.
But we just wanted to come down and be part of this bigger Eucharistic pilgrimage with all these young, wonderful young people and just celebrate Jesus.
Barbara and Owen Loeb drove 3 hours to meet the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage at its northernmost stop.
How does it feel to be a part of it? It feels really wonderful, very fulfilling, very Catholic.
Known for its vibrant historic waterfront, fishing wharfs bringing in fresh seafood, and boats traveling to and from surrounding islands, this is Portland, Maine. Processing through downtown, passing many shops and offices, and curious faces. The Blessed Sacrament, front and center.
This is really nice. If it reminds anybody that they are loved by God, I'm on board.
And how does it feel that the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage is here in Portland, and we're processing through downtown?
Going downtown was lovely. I mean, it really... people were watching. People came out of their houses even to watch. I don't know. I did it because it's action. Prayer is really important, but we must put it together.
He is King. He is alive. Hallelujah. It's alive. Amen.
Among the many participants was Lynn Levasseur, who was part of a group called Disciples of the Eucharist.
We are in love with the Eucharist, and it is our hope that here in Maine, people will also become more in love with the Eucharist. We've been told many times by our pastors that Maine probably has the lowest rate of believing in the true presence. And as time has gone on, we are the last churched as well. And so it is my mission and your mission to bring the good news that you are loved and you are always welcomed home.
Exactly. Same mission.
Amen.
Liv Suhr wants to bring people back to Christ. In a state, Pew Research Center ranks as one of the least religious in the nation, with 2 out of 5 main adults identifying with nothing in particular.
Do you believe people should know more about the true presence of Christ in the Eucharist?
Exactly. You can see when the people see the Christ of this procession, they just stand where they are, you know, to see what is going on. Some people, they ask, we just explain, but, you know, they are very happy, I can tell. Yeah.
Hopefully we change some hearts today.
Adoration was held in many of the parishes in Maine, with some of the churches holding other events, such as a sacred music concert. And the traveling shroud of Turin exhibit. At the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception, the pilgrimage had a special welcoming committee greet them, the children from the church's summer immersion program.
So the children were really excited to greet the Eucharist, and it was really beautiful because I said, what should we do when the Eucharist passes by? And they're like, we should kneel. So it was really beautiful. So they each had flower petals, and they tossed the flower petals so that when Bishop Ruggieri was carrying the monstrance with the Eucharist, they were walking on a bed of flower petals.
As the director of faith formation at the Diocese of Portland, Maine, Avery Felicia incorporates daily adoration in the children's schedule and hopes that it may bear fruit one day.
I think they do start to recognize that they can come to Christ in the Eucharist and pray and talk to him like a friend. And hopefully that will continue throughout the rest of their lives, that they feel really familiar with him.
After Mass was held, a larger Eucharistic procession. The faithful walked with Jesus from the cathedral to the Casco Bay Terminal, where a ferry was waiting to take them to Peaks Island. Once known as the Coney Island of Maine, Peaks Island is the most populous island in Casco Bay, with a close-knit community of more than 1,000 year-round residents.
We are on a ferry to Peaks Island. The Blessed Sacrament is behind me, leading the way, and as you can hear, the singing and chanting hasn't stopped.
Once on shore, the Eucharistic procession continued, leading the pilgrimage to St. Christopher Church, a parish offering a spiritual home for both locals and seasonal visitors.
What I love most about the pilgrimage is just having all these people here and to be able to process down through Portland and then and Peaks Island as well was really kind of a blessing. And it was neat because a lot of people came out of their houses and were on the porches and they were clapping and cheering us on.
After adoration at St. Christopher Church, right outside, a cookout and social with the locals. There we met a group of sisters who drove 7 hours from northern Maine to be part of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage.
Well, every year, for the last couple of years, the sisters have been trying together to do a little pilgrimage somewheres. And this came up, and we felt that our nation really needed prayers.
Sisters Barbara Roy and Verona Martin said their mother had a great devotion to the Eucharist. So in her memory, and to keep the faith alive for many generations to come, they make it a family tradition to attend adoration together at least once a month.
Jesus wants us to spread the faith, and this is one way of doing it, you know, getting people closer to the Eucharist. I think it's probably the most important.
They pray that the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage will change many hearts along the way. Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
And now, on to Philadelphia, the last stop of this 2026 National Eucharistic Pilgrimage, a fitting ending in the very city where the Declaration of Independence was signed on this 250th anniversary of our nation's founding. We are joined by the leader of this weekend's festivities, the Archbishop of Philadelphia, Archbishop Nelson Perez, to give us a preview of the big event. Your Excellency, thank you so much for being with us. How are preparations going ahead of this big pilgrimage finale in Philadelphia this weekend, and how are you feeling about it?
Catherine, I'm super excited and privileged
for the Church of Philadelphia to receive our Eucharistic pilgrims and to adore the Lord in the Blessed Sacrament, who walks with us and accompanies us in life. Such a beautiful, beautiful moment for the Church in the United States, but in particular for the Catholic Church of Philadelphia. And we're ready to go.
That's amazing. And it is fitting for this pilgrimage to conclude in Philadelphia this 4th of July weekend on the anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And Your Excellency, Philadelphia has a rich Catholic history as well. Can you just reflect for a moment on the role Catholicism has played in the city and in the Archdiocese?
The Church of Philadelphia is strong in its Catholic faith and its Catholic culture. It runs through the veins of everybody here. It's one place in the country where even non-Catholics refer to where they live by the parish in which they live. It's an amazing reality culturally. So the presence of the Church in Philadelphia has been for, 200 years close, just lies at the center. You know, our own cathedral lies at the very center of Center City. It's just a beautiful presence of the Church here and the work of the Church, a charitable work of the Church, of wonderful faith-filled people that we'll see come out to adore the Lord and walk with Him.
Mm. And the lives of saints have walked along in Philadelphia as well, which is just a great reminder for us in the present day. And Your Excellency, it was announced this week that Pope Leo will offer a message at the close of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. How significant is it that our Holy Father is participating in this way? And do you have a sense of what his message will be?
I am so profoundly grateful to the Holy Father for his willingness to give us this message to the pilgrims and the Church at large in the United States. It's a sign of his love for us, his care for us, and his walking with us along with our Eucharistic Lord. He was so gracious in doing that. And I'm sure he will call us to pray for the Church, to pray for peace, which is at the heart of his pontificate, peace in the world, and also cling to our Eucharistic Lord, cling to him, because he is the source of our life, the summit of our life in the Eucharist, and we're so incredibly blessed to have him here through this message. Yeah. Here in the city, as you said, the city of two saints, St. Catherine Drexel, St. John Newman.
Yeah. And of course, our Holy Father has his own Pennsylvania connection as well, being a Villanova alum, so that makes it also extra special.
That makes it very special.
Your Excellency, I do want to ask this. You know, we are in the midst of an extreme heat wave here on the East Coast. Any concerns for how that might threaten Eucharistic pilgrimage plans or anything that you want to be sure to share for pilgrims who are planning to be there and might be concerned about that?
Drink a lot of water. Mm-hmm. And it's an opportunity to, it might be a little hot, but it might be an opportunity to include in our prayer that sacrificial offering for peace in the world, for peace in our hearts, for a deepening of our love in the Eucharistic Lord, who I'm sure when he walked the earth, he also walked in the heat as well.
Mm. Great reminder. Stay hydrated and provide that witness to the world. Your Excellency, as the 2026 National Eucharistic Pilgrimage winds down to a close, can you take a moment and speak about the importance of Eucharistic processions, the kind of good fruit that comes from this specific type of public witness of faith and of processing with our Eucharistic Lord?
Well, following the celebration of the solemn mass on Sunday at our cathedral, yes, we're going to walk 2 miles from saint to saint, from the Shrine of Catherine Drexel to the Shrine of St. John Newman. Processions are very special in the Church. It's not a parade and it's not a walk. It's a procession because we're all on a journey. We're all on a journey to heaven. We're all on a journey to that Eucharistic banquet in heaven. So we're all every day, every hour, every moment, we're on a journey. But the Lord journeys with us and he walks with us. And that's the beauty of procession. It's a deeply spiritual reality. It's almost living again the walk of the journey of the disciples of Emmaus, right?
Yeah.
That they were walking. They were walking past, sad. Mm-hmm. And Jesus begins to walk with them. And he says to them, like, what are you talking about? Because we're all talking about things in our heart all day long. And the Lord wants to know that because we're on a journey. We're on a journey to the Lord. But he walks with us, sometimes in front of us, leading the way, sometimes behind us, pushing us forward, most of the time just walking right next to us. Mm. So this journey, this pilgrimage, and this procession are a symbolic reality, an external sign of what really is our life as Christians on a journey. So it's very beautiful.
That's a great reminder. And that we don't walk alone. That's such a great reminder. Our Lord is, he is with us, you know, and those who process are impacted and bystanders as well. Finally, Your Excellency, as we celebrate America's 1776 founding this weekend, what role do you think the Catholic Church has in the U.S. today in 2026? What kind of witness do you think American Catholics are called to be right now, especially amid the modern day challenges?
Without a doubt, in union with our Holy Father, to work, to call for peace, to be that prophetic voice, especially for those that are voiceless, for those in the womb, for those, for our immigrants, for our poor, for those who really need the presence of Christ through the church, to remind all of us that the church, in capital letters, is the sacrament of Jesus Christ. Mm. We are the presence of Christ at this moment with his challenges, with his joys, but we have an incredible, beautiful opportunity to give witness to Christ in the world, especially to those who were most close to him. Mm-hmm. And those that were poor and having a rough time, he had a special place in his heart for those that he wanted to bring close to him. And the church is an instrument and a sign of that wonderful Sacred Heart of Christ that continues to be powerful and vibrant and will always be for all of us, including ourselves.
Yeah. Archbishop Perez, thank you so much for joining us this busy week. We are so looking forward to this weekend. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Catherine. We'll be praying for all of you. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you.
God bless you.
EWTN invites you to be part of the concluding festivities of the 2026 National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. The closing mass will be celebrated at 11 a.m. Eastern this Sunday at Philadelphia's Cathedral Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul, followed by a 2-mile Eucharistic procession through downtown Philadelphia beginning at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. And then we'll conclude with a benediction at the National Shrine of St. John Newman at St. Peter the Apostle Church. Tune into EWTN for full live coverage beginning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern this Sunday. I will be here along with my co-hosts, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, editorial director of EWTN News, and Father Aquinas Gilbo, chaplain and director of campus ministry at the Catholic University of America. And that is a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.